Roundtable Podcasts, underwritten by Proctors, the Capital Region's premier performing arts center featuring the best in entertainment from Broadway and around the globe. Proctors.org.
Today, Black-owned barbershops play a central role in African-American public life. The intimacy of commercial grooming encourages both confidentiality and camaraderie, which makes the barbershop an important gathering place for African-American men to talk freely. But for many years preceding and even after the Civil War, Black barbers endured a measure of social stigma for perpetuating inequality. Through the profession offered economic mobility to Black entrepreneurs, Black barbers were obliged by custom to serve an exclusively white clientele. In his book, Cutting Along the Color Line, Vassar history professor Quincy Mills chronicles the cultural history of Black barbershops as businesses and civic institutions, and it's a great pleasure to welcome him to the roundtable this morning. Thank you very much for being with us, sir. It's a great pleasure to have you on our program.
No, thanks for having me, Joe.
Dr. Mills will be giving a public reading from the book on Thursday, the 30th of January, at 7 o'clock at the Hyde Park Free Library, and will also participate in the Created Equal series that the Poughkeepsie Library District is running in February. And you can find out more information at our website, and we'll talk more about that later on. What got you interested in Black barbers and the barbershops in this country?
Part of it was doing an ethnography of a barbershop on the south side of Chicago, and in the process of sitting inside this barbershop about 4 to 5 days a week, I couldn't help but think a bit about how these barbershops evolved over time. We just sort of assume that they've always been these hubs of Black community interaction, but in fact they have not always been the case. In the process of starting to dig for sources, which I thought would be looking for several needles in mounds of haystacks, I stumbled on this barber, George Myers, out of Cleveland, Ohio, who was William McKinley's barber before he became president. And Myers was a fascinating figure. He even had this fairly large trove of historical documents about his work as a barber, but also about his work in the Republican machine in Ohio and even in the country. And so once McKinley was elected president, African Americans sent letters to Myers asking for Myers to put in a good word with McKinley so they can get patronage positions in their hometowns. And Myers, certainly most of his clientele were wealthy white businessmen, politicians, and he served, again, right, as this central figure in Black politics, largely because of his closeness to power, if you will. And so through the work of Myers, and I just had to sort of wonder, were there other Myerses around the country? Were there other folk who were situated as he was? And certainly I found out that there were, and this opened up an area about barbershop that I quite simply was unaware of.
What is it, and you write about this beautifully in the book, but give us a sense of what makes a barbershop different than another business, in the sense of a place that allows this type of culture to grow, not in one spot in the country, but throughout this country?
Yeah, so barbershops have low barriers to entry. So you don't have to have a substantial amount of money to open a shop. And so for decades, centuries even, African Americans could sort of enter barbering with very little obstacles. Two, barbershops are sort of public spaces that operate in a very private way. And so travelers will often need to get a shave or a haircut when they're, away from home. Getting a haircut, getting a shave are duties of necessity. It has to be done maybe once a week, or if you don't have a whole lot of money, maybe once every 2 weeks. And so you will certainly find men and women sort of frequenting these places quite often. Barbershops are also unique in the way that both the owner and the barbers who are not owners in the shop have a relative sense of autonomy, right? Certainly, we can understand the ways in which an owner would have autonomy, but barbers who were not owners, they did not work for wages, and so therefore they were not tied to the shop in the way that, say, a wage worker would be. Customers are connected to their barber, not necessarily the shop. Certainly, they enjoy the interactions that go on in the shop, but at the end of the day, they go there for a particular barber. And so if the barber leaves to another shop, more often than not, the customer would follow him to the next shop. And so you have these interesting labor relations that go on in barbershops that are unique in that way. You have this way in which the barber is connected to his customers in a very intimate fashion, right? So we know that doctors know their patients well, dentists know their patients well, but barbers don't just know their customers as individuals, but they know the customers as communities, right? They have often seen generations of men come to their shop. They've often seen men come in just to air their grievances, to talk about what's going on in the nation and in the world. And so it becomes this space of commerce, certainly, but it also becomes this community space where men engage with other strangers and comrades on a daily basis.
One of the things that struck me, and this is really from the preface of the book, where you talk about trying to interview barbers, specifically barbers who were operating in the 50s and 60s, but to get their perspectives, and in the South, and you had trouble to find people who would talk to you.
Partly because I had very long dreadlocks, Joe.
Right. Would you say they were more interested in talking to your hair than they were about the history?
Yeah, which, you know, I certainly expected barbers to be curious about my hair. That you know, was quite common. But I didn't expect them to be resistant to talk about the history of barbering because of my hair. And so many of the responses that I got from those Southern barbers back in 2003 to 2004 was that, hey, you don't look groomed, and I'm in the grooming business. Or how does it look that you want to talk to me about barbering, but you haven't cut your hair in I don't know how long? And so while that, I was taken aback, and I was quite surprised and didn't quite know what to do. After a while, it dawned on me that what's critical about barbershops and our contemporary discussions of barbershops is that we've talked very little about the barber.
Right.
We talk about barbershops as spaces where men go and talk and hang out, but what's clear is that barbers, at the very least, have to turn some kind of a profit so they can pay rent and that the space can be there. And so what happens when we bring the barber back into our discussion of the barbershop? How can we think about the economy or the market economy in concert with public discourse? And the ways in which those barbers rejected me, if you will, was a wake-up call for me that I had to really take seriously the barber's work, right? The barber's work of shaving men, the barber's work of cutting their hair, and how they essentially sort of groomed race, if you will, right? How they took pride in making particularly black men look presentable, look respectable, look employable, if you will. And so that helps us think about, for example, we talk about the rise of Afros and Naturals in the 1960s, but barbers, they were quite concerned about the rise of Afros and Naturals, right? Because they thought that would put them out of business. Again, that gets to the economy of the shop. So how can we talk about that market economy alongside the very real political components of Afros and Black Pride? So that was a very startling moment, getting rejected, but it certainly, I think, helped make this a much better book.
What is it, do you think, about the barber specifically that would indicate there is a personality, almost a cult of personality, that comes with this as well, that there is the place, but then there is the individual who is at the helm?
Yeah, so barbers as individuals, certainly any business owner or someone who essentially wants to control the fruits of their own labor. That dates back to slavery. It dates back to the post-emancipation period when African Americans were finally out of the shadows of the institution of slavery. And one of the major things that they wanted was land. They wanted to, again, control the fruits of the labor. I think certainly barbering and owning a barbershop comes out of that tradition of striving for economic self-sufficiency. But also, through that, I think barbers have a particular characteristic about organizing people, right? About organizing spaces, if you will. And much of that comes with the authority that obviously happens inside of barbershops. And so there's a way in which barbershops aren't inherently democratic spaces. I like to say that spaces don't do anything, people do. And so if we think about the role of barbers in that public space, we also have to account for the level of authority that barbers have in deciding if that space will be democratic or not. I don't want to make a blanket statement that all barbers are a particular way or have a particular way of going about their business and their lives. I think certainly there were some barbers who took advantage of their autonomy and were very active in civil rights campaigns. Many said that because they were not beholden to a white employer or to white customers, that they felt free to openly contribute to civil rights campaigns, to sign petitions in ways that, for example, black teachers could not. And so there's a sense of space that the barbershop and the work of barbering, I think, gave black men that, say, some other, for example, wage labor did not.
And it's interesting because there are lines that are drawn here that you write about that go beyond race, obviously. I mean, we as a culture, we as people, once we find a barber that we're happy with, we don't like to change, really.
Yeah, that's right.
I mean, you want it. You want to stay with that person, and there is a comfort, and there is a trust, and a relationship. But what does seem special in these cases, and that you write about, is that space you call the black commercial public sphere. Mm-hmm. What is that?
The black commercial public sphere is, as I was saying earlier, is a move away from thinking about barbershops as simply public spaces. Scholars have talked about the public sphere as this democratic space that is, it was, and is independent of the market economy.
Right.
So that the state, the federal government, had no ties to. So the black church, for example, right, is often talked about as this sort of black public sphere, black newspapers, right, spaces where African Americans can get together, they can engage in political discussions, they can organize, they can strategize, et cetera.
And the beauty shop as well. And the beauty shop as well. I'm sorry.
The beauty shop. So I think about the beauty shop and barbershop together, separate from, say, the black church.
Yes.
And that's largely because of their function in the market economy. There's money involved.
Right.
And I think at times when there's money involved, that can change the nature of one's strategies, of one's goals, of one's existence, if you will. And so barbershops, again, they are places where not only do barbers make money, but newspapers make money, because newspapers are often sold in barbershops historically. And I don't know if they're so much sold today, but they are in barbershops today. And men will often come into barbershops to sell their goods. And so today you can buy a DVD or a CD. Certainly it's a bootleg DVD or CD in many cases. You can buy a watch. You can buy a plant. You can buy socks, right? And you can do that largely because these men know that there will be a group of people who are standing around the barbershop waiting. And so I talk about this sort of waiting public inside of barbershops, right? This space where I guess if you think about Facebook, for example, advertisers know that this is a hub of conversation and social interaction, and advertisers are just vying to get their products in front of all these people who are socializing. And so if we take it out of the ether and put it on the ground in the sort of brick and mortar of barbershops, that's what they were, right? They were these commercial spaces that also operated as very hotbed spaces of conversation and congregation.
It's a fascinating book. It is Cutting Along the Color Line, and it is by Vassar History Professor Quincy Mills, the subtitle Black Barbers and Barbershops in America. The book is published by University of Pennsylvania Press. Dr. Mills will be giving a public reading from the book on Thursday, January 30th at 7 o'clock at the Hyde Park Free Library. He'll also participate in the Created Equal series that the Poughkeepsie Library District is running in February. You can find out more information about all of those events by going to our website, wamc.org/roundtable. Dr. Mills, thank you very much for sharing with us this morning. A great pleasure to speak with you.
Oh, pleasure's all mine. Thank you.
A delight. Thank you very much for spending time. Again, you're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.